Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last summer, stand-up comedian, actor, and liberal, Michael Ian Black, and author and Daily Beast columnist, self-proclaimed conservative and devoted Republican, and daughter of U.S. Senator John McCain, Meghan McClain, traveled together across the country in an RV. The result is a new book about their travels, what they learned about this great big country and each other. They're with us today to talk about their new book, America, You Sexy Bitch. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you.
Meghan, the title of the book was from one of your brainstorms. Tell us that story.
Yeah, and the very controversial title that is either people really love it or love to hate it. We were taking a tour of the Capitol, and the intern that was showing us around was showing us there's a statue of Lady Freedom in the Capitol Hall, and he said, if you noticed, her face is facing east because the sun never sets on freedom. And I said, that's because America's such a sexy bitch. And everybody started laughing, and Michael was like, that should be the title of our book. And I was like, yeah, that should be the title of our book. And then I never thought it would actually be okay. And then it was the type of thing that we were like, yeah, that'll be the title until we come up with a new title. And then it was like 3 weeks away from the deadline. There, does anybody have a better title? The publisher was like, I guess that's the title. And I was like, wait, that shouldn't be, I don't know if this is a good title. But it was kind of too late at that point.
Michael, are you still willing to live with it?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it caught my eye. I love it too, frankly. But
Thank you.
It grabbed me.
I mean, you have a nice sense of humor. Some people find it offensive, and I'm such a strong feminist that people were saying, you know, do you think that using the word bitch in reference to our country or America as a woman is a good thing? And I totally take ownership of the word bitch. You can ask Michael, because he called me a bitch one time, and I was like, that's right. Bitches get things done.
Strong.
I like being called that, totally. I'm a strong, independent woman with a mind that's going to get something done. Call me that all day long. And Madonna has this quote about being called a bitch as well, and she says, I'm strong, I'm independent, I'm driven, and I know exactly what I want, and if that makes me a bitch, fine. And that's exactly how I feel, and it's meant to be campy and a term of endearment. So I apologize to people that are offended.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not, so don't worry about me. Michael, it was your idea to travel together and write the book together. Tell us how that came about. Another interesting story.
Well, I had met Meghan very briefly over satellite when I was shooting a television program, and she was a guest on it. And we started following each other on Twitter. And then one night in an Ambien haze, I tweeted at her and said, we should write a book together. And she said, sure. And then when I woke up, I realized I had asked Meghan McCain to write a book with me, and she had accepted. So we started emailing, and like 8 weeks later, we were on the road.
Meghan, I don't know where you were at that time, but it wasn't as late at night, but were you completely sober when you decided to do that?
I was in Atlanta, and I just made a speech in Atlanta, and when Michael and I were the guy, when I was a guest on the show he was shooting, he was really making fun of me, and I was just giving it to him right back, and I can remember the audience really laughing. And, you know, as you know, sometimes when you're interviewing people or when you're talking with people on air, sometimes it doesn't always go so well. So I had already was hoping that we could maybe work together in the future, because we seem to have a good chemistry together. And then when he offered, I was going through a very bad breakup and a bad professional experience. So I was like, yeah, let's go on the road and write a book. That sounds like the greatest thing to get over all these bad things. So it was just very serendipitous. So, I was sober, though.
If you're just joining us, my guest, Michael Ian Black, author and comedian, and also Meghan McCain, author and political commentator. They've written a new book together. It's just came out. It's called America, You Sexy Bitch. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page as well, or you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. You are, for all intents and purposes, opposites, I guess. Meghan, you're short, and Michael, you're tallish, and Meghan, you embrace your party, and Michael, not so much.
I resent the tallish. I am of above average height.
Well, how tall are you?
Like 5'10".
Right. You know, I was surprised. You referred a couple times, Meghan, to your dad as, or your whole family, the men in your family, as small-framed.
Yeah, no, we're like small people. Like, I love my father very much, but he's not a large man. He's, I think he's like 5'8", 8, maybe. And my grandfathers were very short. They were like 5'5". And in our house in Phoenix is hanging my great-grandfather's old Navy Admiral uniform. And he is, I don't know if I could fit in it. He was a tiny little man. So, and I'm 5, I'm barely 5'1". So.
She comes from a family of hobbits.
Like, we're many things, but we're not tall people.
Well, you know, Michael, you're long time married with children, Megan, not, but you two have a lot in common. Drinking not the least of it or enjoying it when you do it. Megan, in fact, you used the phrase bipartisan mixology in the book's introduction, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, when anyone that's been on the road or, you know, takes any kind of road trips, it was very hot last summer, as it is this summer with all these crazy heat waves. And Michael and I were not getting along, really, or not really connecting when we first were on the road. And I was like, we're going to have to start drinking together because then we'll start bonding and then we will start being friends. So, you know, it worked.
It worked, yeah. I was actually, Michael, a little stressed out at the beginning of the book. I wondered if you guys were going to click or not. It was making me anxious.
Yeah, it was making both of us anxious, too, because we were on what could be described as the longest first date ever. And it was awkward. It was really awkward. We didn't know each other. And incidentally, I'm not a drinker. At least I wasn't before this road trip. I have since developed a problem with all the Bud Lights I've been drinking.
Well, the Jell-O shots alone.
The Jell-O shots alone. We're pretty serious, yeah.
Anyways, you're kind of opposites, but you're not really opposites. I mean, I don't feel like, Michael, you went out with some far right-wing political analyst or commentator. I mean, Megan, you're not, you're a lot of people in the party think of you as a rhino or the Republican in name only.
Yeah, that's true. Go ahead. It's true that we're not extremes, but that was part of the point of the book. Because Americans, in general, aren't extremists. I mean, most people don't live their lives on the fringes of the political parties. But if you watch the media, that's what you see. You see people on either extreme yelling at each other. And Megan and I don't feel like that's representative of what most Americans go through. So we feel like we're closer to what most Americans are like than what you see on the news.
But Megan, you identify very closely with the Republican Party. You love the party.
I love what it means for me and what it means to my family and what it has meant to my father, because I grew up, obviously, you know, I grew up with John McCain as a father, not Rick Santorum, and I spent my childhood, literally my childhood, on campaigns with him, and then as a 13-year-old on his first presidential campaign. And my father's the maverick, you know. He's been known as someone who thinks outside party lines and has an independent streak. So I love what Republican politics has meant for me, and I was always allowed to have that room to grow and room to think about my ideas. You know, I wasn't raised with a right-wing extremist as a father. So my idea of the Republican Party and what I love about the Republican Party is what it has meant in my life and my narrative. People that don't call me Republican enough, 9 times out of 10, they're over 40. I always start with that. And I think for whatever reason, there's a strange resistance to a difference of opinions within the tent of the Republican Party. But I think nothing is more clear than the damage that's being done with the bloodletting, because quite frankly, we're losing members of the Republican Party when it comes to minorities, when it comes to women, when it comes to young people, and something is going to have to give. And if you think I represent extremism, like, there's a whole world out there that you're not seeing.
And Michael, you don't necessarily identify with the Democratic Party.
No, because I consider myself a liberal, and I identify with a lot of Democratic policies, but it's very hard for me to fully embrace a political party. I mean, to me, they are basically money laundering operations and not much more than that, and I can't throw my weight behind them as an organization, although, you know, I like to say that I caucus with them, although I don't have a vote.
And Megan, what about the money that's being spent on politics? It's never going to be greater than it is this election year.
Oh, it'll be in 4 years, I can guarantee.
Well, 4 years it'll be, yes, every 4 years, right.
I think it's scary. I think it's sad. And I think it's what's kind of killing politics right now. I mean, money and politics have always gone together. But I think we're reaching a point right now where, what I worry about more than anything, and I speak at colleges throughout the year all the time, and college students literally say to me, why should I run for office? I'm not a millionaire. So that's what scares me the most, is words like deterring people from being interested in getting involved for office or running for office simply because they're not millionaires.
You know, speaking of millionaires, you bring up the issue of your family's wealth quite a bit. Michael does kind of sort of.
And Michael kept bringing it
in
up.
Backhanded ways. But what, you know, on the other hand, you know, Michael, you're not starving in Connecticut, but.
Yeah, exactly, Michael. Yeah.
But why did you guys decide to stay in such crappy hotels and ride in an RV with no air conditioning? Couldn't you just, you know, taken it up a notch?
No, I mean, because okay. we didn't get paid a lot of money for this book.
Okay.
Yeah. And, we had a budget.
Yeah, I mean, we had, you know, we had to split the advance, and then we had to pay for the trip out of whatever, you know, we had. So we were for all intents and purposes doing it on a pretty strict budget. And if you think I'm going out of pocket to write this book, you're out of your
and
mind.
And I think part of it, if we had been on, you know, a pimped out tour bus, that's not really the way you're going to get Americans to engage with you. And I love being on the road. I don't care if it's in a van or an RV or whatever. I mean, I have spent probably years in all total in my life in 15 passenger vans driving across America that did have air conditioning, even though our RV didn't really. And, you know, I just think it's a better way to get around. It's a better way to get to know people. And I don't think the book would have had, we would have had such a great experience if we were, you know, living like rock stars.
And I would agree, you know, a lot of your entries read in terms of your life on the road a few years ago when your dad ran for president. And back then you were well recognized. At this time, you know, not so much, right?
Yeah, no, I obviously when I was with my father, we were, you know, it was so scripted and we were going to, and I mean that in the sense that, you know, we had advanced people that would get a situation literally ready for us before we would go there, and people knew what they were coming to see. And Michael can attest, I look like I am a college student when I don't have makeup on and I'm wearing cut-off shorts. And I hardly ever get recognized ever unless I'm all done up wearing makeup and like, you know, a suit or something. So, no. But people recognize Michael all the time.
From the Crocs and the linen pants?
Yeah. I think they recognize him from different TV shows.
From being very famous, man. Very famous.
That's right. My guests are Michael Ian Black, author and comedian, actor, and also Meghan McCain. She's author and political commentator. She's a writes column for The Daily Beast. We're going to return to our conversation with them about their new book and talk more about it. It's called America, You Sexy Bitch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In his new book, Rajiv Chandrasekaran tells a story about Afghanistan 50 years ago, when the U.S. pumped in money and people to win hearts and minds and failed. He told PBS,
"You could change the names and the dates, and it's like you're writing about today."
I'm Neil Conan, Little America, the war within the war for Afghanistan. Rajiv Chandrasekaran joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 78 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Expect sunshine throughout the day. There is a slight chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm. And a heat advisory is in effect this afternoon with a high of 92 degrees. Cloudy skies tonight with a chance of showers and thunderstorms popping up, about a 30% chance, a low of 68. Partly cloudy for tomorrow with still that chance of showers and thunderstorms, and again a high of 92. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Guests are Michael Ian Black, author and comedian and actor, and also Meghan McCain, author, political commentator. She writes a column as well, a week to come for The Daily Beast. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about a month-long journey they took last summer from coast to coast, north to south, and they wrote a book about it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Terry in Youngstown, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Well, thank you, Ann. I'd like to know about how did this, both families like this this collaboration, especially Mr. with John McCain being very Republican and this being Democrat. You know, How did Mr. McCain like this collaboration?
Okay, so first of all, the title of the book, Meghan McCain.
It's called America, You Sexy Bitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, my father didn't really understand what we were doing at first. He he didn't even know who Michael was, let alone was a fan. And he was just skeptical of me going on the road with a 40-year-old married Democrat. He was like, why?
I don't know why. I don't understand that at all.
And, you know, this isn't why, in the beginning, this wasn't his favorite project I've ever done. And it took a lot of faith. I just said, trust me, please. I promise you this is something that will be worthwhile and is fun and ridiculous and is, again, another way to reach out to young people using politics. And he didn't like it, but just recently he's really come around. And I think it's because he has a very good friend that read it and just started raving about it. And then my father read parts of it, and he really liked it. So, you know, he's come around. It took a little while, though.
And Michael Ian Black, what about you? What about your spouse?
She loved it. You know, I think she really loves Meghan. I think, you know, you would think, like, your wife would be a little bit dubious when you're like, hey, honey, I'm going on the road for a month with a 27-year-old hot blonde Republican. But, you know, we've been married 12 years. She doesn't care what I do. She's like, go.
But I think we're lucky that I got along really well with Michael's wife when we first met, and she's very cool and sort of, yeah, she's very, like, wise. I think she's kind of seen it all with you, Michael, and she was excited about the project.
Yeah, he wore in for you. Terry, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Well, I thought it was interesting. You sort of started out the whole journey by meeting your families. Meghan, you met Michael's mom out in California. I guess it was California, I think. And likewise, Michael, you met Meghan's mother and some of her brother, one of her brothers or two of her brothers in
I met both of her brothers.
Arizona.
And her sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about that, Michael.
Well, I had an impression of Cindy McCain just from the presidential campaign. I mean, I sort of thought she was aloof and kind of out of touch, and I couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, she was the most gracious, warm, welcoming woman. She fully embraced me and the project, and I was, you know, I was surprised, and it speaks to, I guess, my own stereotypes. The stereotypes that I have about people and my willingness to believe everything that I sort of see portrayed on the television. And, you know, sometimes those media narratives are just flat out wrong. And in this case, it was wrong. I mean, she's just the loveliest person. And, you know, I didn't know about I call her Cindy because we're buddies now. What I didn't know about Cindy is that, you know, she spends a tremendous amount of time working in the Congo, and doing all kinds of philanthropic work that, you know, she doesn't have to do. You know, she could be, you know, hanging out, doing whatever she wants, but she chooses to spend her time helping other people, and I can't express how commendable I think that is.
Yeah, and in fairness, Michael and my mom had like a weird relationship and connection from the beginning. I mean, my mom doesn't really like a lot of people when she first meets them. I mean, she does, but, you know, in this situation, again, Michael, a 40-year-old liberal comedian that's married, like, it's not who I would pick that my mom would, like, adore, but she's borderline obsessed with Michael. She, like, loves him and thinks he's so hilarious, and I can say something and she thinks it's offensive, and if Michael says it, she thinks, oh, it's just Michael. It's so funny. It's just Michael being Michael, Meghan. So, I mean, it's nice for me, and that's sort of how my father came around, too, because my mom was like, he's really a good guy, and, you know, they're doing great things together. So my mom was a big help with all of that.
Yeah, because before you could go across the country and dispel stereotypes about others and everyone out there, you had to do it about each other.
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, part of it was we had to really confront the stereotypes that we had about each other and sort of break them down and about ourselves, incidentally, and really sort of acknowledge what was true and what wasn't. And sort of what was really fun about it was the amount of time we spent laughing at ourselves. You know, I mean, politics is always so grim in this country and so humorless. And we had such a great time doing this because I think we were really able to laugh and we were really able to laugh at each other. Look, I laughed more at Meghan because she's more ridiculous than I am, but it was
That's
fun.
True. I'll give you that. I'm more disciplined.
I loved it. I read the advance copy, and it's all dog-eared. But then I've got the final, you know, version, the hardcover, and I thought, oh, they have pictures too. That was a lot of fun to put the pictures with the stories. Rebecca in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Hey, thanks. I'm calling for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm middle of the road politically, and so I truly, truly, truly appreciate the show and the fact that there's someone from the right, someone from the left, I don't know, actually conversing, because that's real life, right? When you have a job, don't you have to get along with all kinds of people and make it work no matter what? I'm so sick and tired of political radio shows and TV shows, one side bashing the other side, all these wound up tight, whirly gigs screaming and yelling at each other. So I just wanted to call in and say thank you for the show. Thank you for the two of you. And I'm definitely going to run out by the book.
Thank you. That's so sweet. Thank you.
Well, it's true.
Well, thanks for listening, Rebecca.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye bye. And Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hi, I'll try not to crash the car here on I-71.
Please do.
Rebecca took the words right out of my mouth. I believe it's extremism that's killing the Congress and the TV shows as well. And it's a breath of fresh air to see people from the two parties able to converse and get along. And nothing sickened me more this past week than the raging harpy who founded the Tea Party screaming on the steps of the Supreme Court. I thought, why would anybody want to interview that person who's so filled with hate? Anyway, I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, Phil, thanks a lot. Just to remind you, if you're just joining us, my guests are Meghan McCain and also Michael Ian Black. They've co-authored a new book. It's called America, You Sexy Bitch. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, Meghan and Michael, the issue of health care reform.
Of raging harpies?
Yeah.
I love that. I know.
Awesome. Well, I mean, Meghan, I don't know if it was irate at a tweet that you did or a column or something I've read recently about how you reacted when you found out how the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Affordable Care Act.
I did. I mean, I didn't do it publicly. I wasn't out on the Supreme Court staff screaming, but I was in my apartment when I first watched it. I just yelled. Like, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, really loud to the point that I was worried that my neighbors were going to, you know, think something was going on. But I would not scream in public. Again, it's in the privacy of my apartment. I was alone. But I get people get, you know, passionate about these issues that are really going to change lots of things in people's lives. And I think when it comes to that gentleman that, you know, that the caller was talking about, the cameras are going to interview him because he's going to give the best quotes and he's going to be the most extreme and it's going to be the most entertaining, which is, you know, sad commentary on journalism today.
I also think that a lot of this comes from, I think leadership comes from the top down in a lot of cases, and the tenor of the conversation comes from the top down. So I think it's encouraged in a weird way for people to be that passionate and over the top in the way that they react to news because they see their leaders doing it. And so you sort of think, well, that's how political discourse is conducted in this country. And it doesn't have to be. You don't have to be, you know, you don't have to have the vapors every time something happens. You can react in a calm and civilized way. Or if you want to scream at your television in the privacy of your own apartment, you can do that, too.
But the issue was something that you two argued about quite a bit on the road.
Oh, yeah. We couldn't agree on health care really at all and the way it should be delivered in this country. And that's fine. I mean, look, Meghan and I I'm not a health care expert. Meghan's not a health care expert. We both have our opinions about it. And we weren't out trying to save the union. We were just trying to have a conversation. And hopefully show others that it can be done, that you can have the conversation, and hopefully smarter people than us will come up with the actual solutions. But yeah, we disagreed a lot, and healthcare was one of the big ones we disagreed about.
You agree, Meghan?
Yeah, it still remains, and it's a little ironic that while we're promoting the book, it's obviously come back into the forefront of the news cycle and, you know, exactly what's going on in the world. But it's one of the we have a few issues that we just could not find any middle ground at all whatsoever, and this was one of them. And the biggest fight we got in on the road where we had to take a time out and not talk to each other was over healthcare.
What did you two come to agree on?
Well, we both agree that there's too much partisan politics in Washington and that we all need to make a better effort to get along. We both agree on gay marriage. What else do we agree on, Michael?
Legalization of marijuana.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah, we're both. I mean, Michael's pretty fiscally conservative, I have to say. I mean, I know he's a Democrat, but he's more fiscally conservative than I would have thought. That's probably where it ends.
Well, those are some pretty big things.
That about covers it.
Megan, you made some news with your declaration in the book that you believe marijuana should be decriminalized or legalized?
Both. Decriminalized and legalized and, you know, regulated and taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it would get some attention just because there aren't very many Republicans other than Ron Paul that will publicly make that statement. But I just, after our experience on the road, and I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and just seeing how rampant marijuana use is everywhere, and how I have friends that have marijuana medical cards just for anxiety. And I think anybody living in America right now probably has some anxiety about something. Like, everybody has anxiety. And I felt like it would be a really formidable and interesting way to stimulate the economy. And for whatever reason, because of social stigmas, it's not even being discussed.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've made the distinction a couple times, Michael. Megan has made the distinction that she is in many ways culturally liberal, and that you're fiscally conservative. You're also married. You're conventionally married with two kids in Connecticut. So you're not so liberal. You've described yourself more as maybe libertarian.
No. I don't know. I mean, liberal and libertarian sort of, I think, get kind of confused a little bit in mm-hmm. people's minds. But I would say, no, I'm actually more liberal than libertarian, meaning that I do think the government can play a role in helping people's lives. And, you know, I've never met anybody who hasn't said they are fiscally conservative. You know, everybody says they're fiscally conservative, myself included.
I know people that aren't.
Don't you dare disagree with me on public radio, Megan McCain. Don't you dare undermine me on this television. I mean, on the radio, excuse me.
It's okay. It is on television. You just aren't.
I know people that are.
But what do they say? I mean, what do they say? Like, I think we should just
They believe in big government, big time, and that it's our job to spread the wealth around. You know,
well, I certainly believe in bigger government than Megan does, but I also consider myself a fiscal conservative, and by that I mean, yes, I think the government has a place, but I think you have to keep pretty tight reins on it, because like any organization, if you give the government an inch, they'll take a mile. It's the same with corporations.
Yeah, he's correct.
What is the one thing, Michael, that you did on the trip that you would have sworn you never in a million years would you have ever been caught dead doing something like that?
Hang out in Branson, Missouri.
Okay. That's post-trip what he would do.
Yeah. Branson, Missouri.
And more than that, love Branson, Missouri. That's the other thing. That's the other half of it that I never thought I would say. I loved Branson.
And not ironically, we both genuinely loved our experience at Branson. It was a really good time. I don't know why people make fun of Branson.
Neither of you had been there before, right?
No.
No, I'd never been to Branson.
So it was something you actually discovered together, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I expected it to be just really sort of corny and phony, and it was kind of the opposite. I mean, it was so kind of warm and wholesome in a good way and just fun. I mean, it was just really fun.
The Yakov Smirnoff episode, however, I was really getting stressed out for Megan. It was painful to read about. It was really funny how you said you had a quarter-life crisis over the whole ordeal. I had to stop and think, wait a minute, quarter-life? Okay. Tell us about that, Megan, and why Yakov Smirnoff, the comedian, or former comedian, still alive, why that
bothered
you. He's still alive and kicking. Whether he's funny or not is the question.
We went and saw Yakov Smirnoff, and we had wanted to meet him beforehand because this book was all about hearing American stories. And, you know, he's a great, he was a great, I don't know, I still think he's a great American success story.
He is.
Because
mm-hmm.
he's in Branson and he still has a show and, you know, he's still kicking and, you know, creating comedy for better or worse. And I'm so curious at this point because Michael talked about him on the Tonight Show or the Late Show with David Letterman. And this story has gotten so much attention. I wonder if he regrets not meeting with us now. but we saw his show and, you know, it's not my kind of comedy. Clearly, Michael is the comedian I decided to work with, and he is much racier and over the top. It just felt very hokey and like he hadn't updated his material in 25 years, maybe 30, and he spent a significant portion of his act trying to sell his other shows and his products and whatever, which is fine. I get it. Like, Yakov Smirnoff has to hustle, whatever. But my reaction to him was so bizarre. I literally was sitting watching his show, having a panic attack to the point that I almost left in the middle of it. And I was just thinking, what if this is my life? What if in 30 years from now, these are all the interesting stories I have to tell and it's over and I'm not doing enough with my life. And again, like I told you, I had gone through a bad professional experience and a bad breakup. And I think I was just putting off those feelings. And for whatever reason, they all came and bubbled up in the middle of Yakov Smirnoff's act in Branson, Missouri. So, hooray.
Yeah, and it was noticeable, Michael, right, that she was disturbed?
She had a total psychotic meltdown in Branson, Missouri after seeing Yakov Smirnoff.
It wasn't psychotic, but I started crying afterward. Michael was like, what is going on?
Assumed I had done something because you were always mad at me about one thing or another. I'm like, what did I do now?
And I was like, Michael. And he's like, I don't know how to handle this 26-year-old woman like having an emotional breakdown because Michael, I love you, but he's not the most emotional person in the entire world. And I was like, you're here in front of me right now, and you are going to help me through this, whether you like it or not.
Well, Michael, you were never worried about ending up like Yakov Smirnoff, apparently.
Oh my God, I hope I end up like Yakov Smirnoff. My expectations for myself are really low, so if I'm still alive even, you know, and performing at all, I'll be thrilled.
Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm enjoying the show.
Thank you.
And I do have a question. I was interested a moment ago when Anne asked you if there were any issues that you did not agree on at all. But what I'm really interested in is hearing the discussion about if you had any discussions on immigration reform and the problems that we're facing in this area. So that's what I want to hear about.
All righty.
Sure. Michael and I, again, we disagree on the majority of things other than, you know, the things we referenced earlier, marijuana legalization and gay marriage. That's pretty much where it begins and ends. For better or worse, we didn't really change each other's minds so much as just have a conversation about them. And we had lots of conversations about immigration reform. That's another thing Michael and I don't really agree on. Right, Michael?
Yeah, I would say that's one of the things we don't agree on, yeah. Well, you know, Megan's from Arizona, so this is a very hot-button issue for her, and she knows a lot more about it than I do. You know, my feeling is like, yeah, let everybody in, it's fine.
Well, I'm from Arizona, too. That's part of the interest I have.
How do you feel if you're from Arizona?
Well, I personally see, I'm working with young people, I see the talent, I see the ambition, I see the really strong family values, and I see this as a very positive thing that is coming into our society. And I think we have to make it possible for immigrants with good records to become legal citizens in some way. That I think it has to happen. Period.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I mean, to me, we've gotten ourselves into such a bind because for decades, so many people in this country have sort of turned a blind eye to illegal immigration. And then when it no longer suits them, they say, all right, well, now we have to deport everybody, or now we have to enforce all these harsh immigration laws. And the fact is, like, with a wink and a nudge, you kind of invited these people to your home, and now you want to kick them out. So I agree that there's a problem. I agree that undocumented immigrants is a legitimate problem in this country. But I also think we've got to solve that problem and not criminalize it.
That's right.
Meghan McCain, would you like to?
You know, I agree with, you know, what your caller and what Michael have said in the sense that, you know, if you come here and go through the direct channels and the legal channels to get into this country, I have absolutely no problem with, you know, immigration is a great part of American history and which makes us so great. The problem I do have, and I'm not including DREAM Act students or children that were brought here under, you know, at a young age and have, for all intents and purposes, are Americans. I don't include those people. The problem I have is if that, you know, a bunch of illegal immigrants came here, obviously illegally, that they're still pushed to the front of the line behind a lot of people that are doing, going through the proper channels and doing the correct things to become a citizen in America. And to me, that's what's un-American, is that you can sort of cut the line because you came in a different way than another person. And again, I don't include young people or dreamers in that because I think that's an entirely different situation. And I think that Arizonans don't have the luxury to sit back on the East Coast and judge how things are being done. I did not agree with, you know, 90% of SB 1070, but I don't like how Arizona is portrayed in the media because we're dealing with this.
SB 1070 meaning the law that in
the,
Arizona, the Arizona
controversial
law.
Immigration law.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Joanne, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guests, Michael Ian Black, author and comedian, and also Meghan McCain, author and political commentator. They've written a new book. We're talking about that. It's called America, You Sexy Bitch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at an eventful term of the U.S. Supreme Court with Adam Liptak, who covers the court for the New York Times. Besides the landmark ruling on the Affordable Care Act, there were decisions on immigration policy, juvenile sentencing, campaign finance regulations, and more. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow morning at 10. A new look at exercise with Gretchen Reynolds, author and columnist for the New York Times. We'll also discuss the 19th annual Doodah Parade in Columbus, and we will have Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media and gadgetry. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus School for Girls. Information about the academic curriculum in an all-girl environment is available at CSG's Summer Admission Coffee, Tuesday, July 10th. More information at columbusschoolforgirls.org.
The WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy two-for-one admission subject to availability. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Visit WOSU.org. Sunny skies today. There is a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm, a high of 92. Clouds tonight with a chance of rain, a low of 68. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guests, Meghan McCain, author and political commentator, and also Michael Ian Black, author, comedian, actor. If you're just joining us, we're talking about their new book. It's called America, You Sexy Bitch. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Meghan, at one point in the book, you roundly, and I don't use that word very often, condemn Hollywood types who try to tell the rest of us what to do, especially in terms of the environment. What does that make Michael? Even though I know he lives in Connecticut, he's not exactly Hollywood, but he's pretty Hollywood for me.
You know, I wasn't talking about politics in general, although sometimes I do think that, you know, I just personally don't appreciate Sean Penn speaking the way he does about Republicans and Americans. I have always found this sort of strange elitist attitude. And again, I lived in Los Angeles for almost 9 months, and I have, in my entire life, I've never felt in any way like being a Republican separated me from social situations. People in New York do not care. In LA, people cared. And I got, I wouldn't say harassed, but I definitely got, I wasn't treated very nicely in different social situations. So I do believe that there is a sort of liberal bias in Hollywood. And the quotes and the chapter you're speaking about was in reference to climate change. And I think pretty much everyone can believe in climate change at this point. I mean, look at the heat wave we're literally having at this very moment. And I said part of the problem with the movement is the way that it has been discussed by Hollywood liberals, in the sense that Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio and Lori David, who is Larry David's wife, you know, just go on and on about, you know, saving the environment and going green. For a lot of Americans, they're worried about their jobs. They're worried about putting food on the table. They literally cannot afford to go green, and Hollywood isn't making it easier. And I just find hypocrisy in Lori David. She built a pool on her house in Martha's Vineyard and destroyed a lot of protected wetlands and was fined for that, and flies private everywhere, which probably leaves a larger, leaves a larger footprint, carbon footprint, than average Americans. So it was just more the criticism of the way the movement is translated and talked about. And I think we need, a different kind of voice speaking about climate change.
Michael, I wondered, you know, if you shared or you can relate to Megan's impression of the West Coast and the liberal bias that she talked about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question that Hollywood has a liberal bias. And I take Hollywood to task a little bit in the book, because while it's true that sort of on social issues and on environmental issues, Hollywood has a very liberal bias, it's also true when it comes to specifically sexual issues, it's actually a very conservative place. When these issues start to affect their bottom line, Hollywood becomes very conservative. This is why we don't see a lot of actors coming out, for example. And the fact is, like, I know, that a lot of movie stars are gay, but they're afraid to come out because it will impact the bottom line. Studios don't want them to come out because of the very real fear that it will affect box office. And so there's a kind of like, you know, to me it's a sort of hypocrisy when it comes to that specific social issue about Hollywood and its supposed liberal bias.
Bob in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you. Very good show.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest, and that is, first question is, what do each of them think of Sarah Palin? And second of all, what does each of them think about Sarah Palin's impact on the campaign? Thank you much.
Thanks, Bob. Megan, you want to take a swat at that?
Michael, you go first.
Okay.
I want to hear what Michael has to say first.
I think Sarah Palin's effect on the campaign to this point is negligible to non-existent, and I think it will continue to be. I think she had a meteoric rise, and a kind of understandable meteoric rise during the McCain campaign, because she was a plain-spoken, fiery Washington outsider, charismatic, and, you know, as for her, I think enough has been said to sort of denigrate Sarah Palin. I won't do that. But I think she had a lot to offer the conversation, and I'm glad that she is no longer part of the political scene.
Meghan McCain?
You know, I have a complicated feelings towards Sarah Palin, because I was there when she first came, literally the first day I ever met her, when she was first introduced to the world, and I loved her. I thought she was a woman with five kids that was smart and feisty and was going to take on Washington, and I thought all of these positive things. I think it's very sad how her legacy has sort of gone from that point to the point it is now, which a lot of it was impacted by extremely disloyal staffers that no one I know and no one in Republican politics that I know will have anything to do with, because of their such egregious disloyalty to my father and to her. So I don't think she was treated fairly by the media or by a lot of my father's staff. I was disappointed when she resigned from office, from her governorship, and I would have had wished she would have gone on to fight in politics, because there aren't enough women fighting in politics. But it's her own personal decision, and I don't know any more than anyone else does. I would have liked to see her continue on her path, specifically holding office. But I think those times are over, as Michael said.
Mm-hmm. Back last summer, when you were on your journey, it wasn't crystal clear that Mitt Romney would be the GOP nominee for president. Yet you visited Salt Lake City and the Mormon Tabernacle. I don't think you got into it, but anyways, did you learn anything there that sheds light on the man who would be president, Michael Ian Black?
No, I don't think you can know somebody from their religion. You can know maybe certain aspects about them. And look, we spent a day in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pretend that we gleaned any insights about Mitt Romney from that day, other than that if his personality, it mirrors the people that we met there. He's probably very polite and probably has very well-pressed pants.
You know, I actually did think Mitt Romney was going to be the nominee, and I've thought Mitt Romney was going to be the nominee since about almost 3 years ago. You know, Republican politics is sort of all about who waits in line and who waits their turn, traditionally becoming the next nominee, and he was next in line. And even at the height of, I remember there was all that Newt Gingrich hype going on, and, you know, during the debates when he's making such a splash. And I said on MSNBC, I would bet my entire career that Newt Gingrich will never be the nominee, Republican nominee for president. And at the time, people were like, oh, that's such a crazy thing to say. Are you sure you want to say that? And I was like, I'm saying it. So I did think that Mitt Romney was going to be the nominee, and I actually do think he's going to be our next president, no matter what Michael thinks. When we went to Salt Lake City, it was just more curiosity about Mormonism in general. In Arizona, there's a big Mormon population, but I had never visited a temple, and it was more trying to have a greater understanding of the faith than specifically Mitt Romney.
Michael asks an interesting question in the book. Can a country that prides itself in individualism actually have an identifiable type to hold up as exemplar of all that is America? Now, you did meet a couple, Cargill and his wife Jess in Austin, who seemed almost to fit the bill. Michael, am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're a great Austin couple.
So what is it that they exemplify?
They really exemplified a kind of I was struggling not to use a curse word, so I'll just say an effete American independence and a kind of we are who we are and judgment be damned. Which I think is really sort of emblematic of who we are as a country, who we aspire to be anyway. He's a screenwriter. What does she do, Megan?
Oh, she would prefer not to say. That's why we didn't put it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very into you know, sci-fi and nerdy things, and you know, they go to these conventions, and they're like a lot of people in that they have these very specific, very kind of niche-y interests, and they just want to be left alone to do what they do, and they've carved out a kind of beautiful life for themselves where they do that. And I think it was kind of inspirational to see that, because it sort of reaffirmed to me that sort of life, that sort of freedom is possible in this country, and you can have a kind of modest, lovely, free life here.
People like that sort of popped up throughout the book. There was Chicken Willie.
Oh,
sure.
Yes, there was.
Chicken Willie's living right on the fringes of the law, you know.
Chicken Willie. Yeah, that kind of cracked me up. And even though it's a horrible, if what he does is true, which you'll have to read the book to find out.
Yeah.
Did you, Michael, you shot a gun for the first time. I was impressed.
I loved it.
Many times.
I shot many guns many times. And it was very satisfying. I like shooting the earth. I was trying to shoot targets, but I was just shooting mounds of dirt because I wasn't coming anywhere near the target. But it was incredibly satisfying to pull a trigger and see death come out of the barrel. I loved it.
And Megan, that was sort of something that you did reach Michael on. He is not going to turn into a gun nut or anything, but guns are, you know, they're an important part of the lifestyle that you grew up with, firearms. And
hell yeah, they are.
Yeah,
I'm very excited. I'm going home for the 4th of July. So excited. That's the first thing I'm doing.
Go shoot yourself some guns.
Tomorrow. Going to Scottsdale Gun Club with my brothers. Very exciting.
Well,
yeah.
You were impressed by Michael's reaction, though. It wasn't a complete turnoff.
No, I mean, I expected him. I've taken people shooting before, and I understand if you have never shot a gun before and you don't know anything about the NRA or, you know, you just know sort of the social stereotypes, that you wouldn't want to do it. And Michael was like, let's get this going. And he really liked it. He shot every gun my brother gave him, and he seemed to have a good time, and he wasn't scared, and he wasn't shaking, and surprised everybody. But I really wanted to show him, because that's another big issue that we don't have a ton of common ground on. I just wanted to show him my perspective growing up around gun culture and shooting and being a lifelong NRA member, you know, what this means for me. And it goes beyond just enjoying the sport of, you know, target practice or skeet shooting or hunting. And I think he got a better understanding of what it means when people are so proud of being Second Amendment supporters.
What do you mean I wasn't shaking? What did you think was going to happen?
Steffi started shaking. Our tour guide,
Steffi. You think I'm
going to
start weeping? And
people have. Steffi, our tour guide, started shaking afterwards.
Oh, and there's Steffi, and then there's Cousin John. I mean,
Steffi and Cousin John. I know.
Yeah.
Not everybody reacts positive, Michael. It's not a thing I
would
ever
man,
take lightly.
I'm a man, damn it. I'm a man.
I mean, and for the record, he had a big safety course in the beginning, and I'm all about gun safety as well. It wasn't like I just handed him, you know, a gun and was like, go forth. I mean, there was a lot of people around
right.
gun safety.
The rest of us were safe the entire time.
Yes, I mean, it wasn't dangerous. But, you know, like, Steffi was not having it and did not like it. And, you know, I think Steffi actually was kind of closed-minded and still remains. I mean, I don't bring it up with her anymore because I just don't think she wants to talk about it.
Well, there was that thing at Fort Campbell, too. You went there and did their, I don't know what kind you call it.
Simulator.
Simulator,
yeah.
Right. That seemed scarier.
It was scarier to me.
Yeah.
And that was this big room that they have in an army base in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where they train soldiers to react in hostile environments. So it in a sense, it looks like a video game. It's a big room with a huge wall-sized screen, and they can project simulated environments onto that wall. And you are given an M16, adapted, obviously, to shoot lasers. And you work with your platoon, and you fire, and you train. And being in that environment, in that simulated hostile terrain, was far more sort of frightening and bewildering and illuminating than shooting actual guns in Arizona, because for the first time, like, you saw, I sort of saw how the stakes could be real and how frightening and all sort of enveloping that was. And I was really shaken when we did that.
Let's see, you were in Arizona, Las Vegas, Utah, Nashville, Memphis,
Branson.
Dearborn, Michigan,
yeah,
Washington, D.C., Branson, Missouri.
Branson.
Any favorite? That's a lot in a month, actually.
New Orleans,
that's right.
A big high point.
Oh, yeah.
It's being a big high point for us, I think. Just because it was really when we sort of, I think that's when Michael and I were just like, we're going to be lifelong friends, and even if we're arguing every day, like, this is, it's fine now. And that's when we got in a huge fight, and then we ended up going out and taking a tour of Treme and drinking and getting high together. And then the next day we took a tour of the Ninth Ward, which was the exact opposite experience. It was very sad and sort of somber. But I think, Michael, when you say New Orleans, is kind of like when we were like, okay, like release any kind of anger or anything or irritation
yeah.
we have towards each other.
I'd been to New Orleans before, purely in a tourist capacity, and while I was still a tourist, I'd never really gotten out of the French Quarter before. Touring Treme, touring Algiers, touring the Ninth Ward really opened my eyes to what the city was all about, the rich, rich history of that city, the depth of that city, the in a way that no other American city has. The history in that city just lives with you as you walk through it with people who are from there. And that was the first time I really appreciated that. And I was thrilled to be there with Megan.
Megan McCain, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Megan McCain, she's author, political commentator, and co-author with Michael Ian Black, America, You Sexy Bitch. I don't know why I can't say it all. Michael Ian Black, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.